Welcome back, everybody, to our Sunday school class, Encounters with Jesus, episodes from the Gospel of Mark. And today we're looking at blessings from the bread of life from Mark chapter 8, verses 1 through 10. This is a second feeding of the multitude story that reveals that Jesus is the bread of life for the Gentiles. So Mark chapter 8, verse 1 says, "In those days when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, 'I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away.' And his disciples answered him, 'How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?' And he asked them, 'How many loaves do you have?' They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them, and they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full, and there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha." Well, Yogi Berra, who is the famous New York Yankees Hall of Famer catcher, was known for his ability to mangle the English language into quotable quips that oddly made sense or were just plain comical. Some examples would be, Yogi said, "It ain't over till it's over." "You can observe a lot by watching." "It's deja vu all over again." Well, if we can borrow from Yogi, this episode from Mark's Gospel feels like deja vu all over again. Because it was just a couple of chapters ago that Jesus fed the 5,000 in Mark chapter 6, verses 30 to 44. In fact, the similarities between Mark 6 and Mark chapter 8 have led some critics to accuse Mark of a memory lapse, of losing his place, of getting the chronology wrong. But as we'll see, this is not a memory lapse at all. The story fits well with the flow of Mark's gospel. It's not a retelling of the first story. It's a completely separate event. And Jesus himself acknowledges in Mark chapter 8, verses 19 and 20, that these were two separate events, two separate feedings of the multitudes. There are similarities between Mark 6 and Mark 8. Some similarities would be a great crowd has gathered. Jesus shows compassion. The meal is composed of bread and fish. The crowd reclines on the ground in both stories. Thousands are fed. There is abundance. They eat and are satisfied. There are leftovers. And after the miracle, they get in a boat and leave. So those are some similarities between the two stories. But there are differences. In the first story, 5,000 plus people are fed in just one day. Here it's 4,000. We're with him for 3 days. With the 5,000, it was the disciples who initiated the discussion, who were distressed and said, "Jesus, how are we going to feed all of these people?" With the 4,000, it's Jesus who initiates the discussion with his disciples. In the first miracle, Jesus uses 5 loaves and 2 fish. In the second miracle, he uses 7 loaves and a few small fish, you know, these little sardines. When they clean up after the first miracle, they picked up 12 small baskets of bread. After the second miracle, it was 7 baskets of leftovers. The first miracle was predominantly in Jewish territory. This miracle here in Mark chapter 8 was in Gentile territory. So why would Mark do this? Why would Mark include a very similar miracle? He's included multiple examples of Jesus' healing ministry. When Jesus casts out demons, there are multiple stories about these topics. Why not include multiple feeding miracles? Because Mark's purpose is to inform us that Jesus is the Son of God. And he does this in several different ways to show us that Jesus has the authority to reconfigure nature in order to accomplish his purposes. It's something that the disciples had trouble grasping, and it is something that we also have trouble grasping. And so it's repeated for us. It's repeated for their benefit. It's repeated for our benefit. So in this story, we see Jesus' compassion, the compassion of Christ. We see the dullness of the disciples, spiritually dull, spiritually hard-hearted. And then we see blessings from the bread of life. There are spiritual lessons that can be drawn from this enacted miracle, this enacted parable about Jesus and his ministry. So first of all, let's look at the compassion of Christ. That's in verses 1 through 3. Jesus has shown compassion multiple times in Mark's gospel. It's always so reassuring to watch how Jesus interacts with people and meets their needs. But now we hear about Christ's compassion directly from his own lips in verse 2. I have compassion on the crowd. This deep, gut-level compassion that demonstrates Jesus' tender care for the multitudes. We're told in verse 1 that again, a great crowd has gathered. Maybe this is a veiled reference to the feeding of the 5,000, perhaps, that a great crowd gathered then. Here is another great crowd gathering. Jesus is in the Gentile territory. Then he was in Jewish territory. Now he's in Gentile territory, conducting a mini Bible conference of sorts, these intensive teaching sessions. And it's been 3 days and counting that he's been teaching them. There's a food shortage. They are in a desolate place, far from civilization. There are no golden arches around to just go and pick up lunch or dinner. There's no organized system of food distribution. The food that has been brought is now running out. Personal provisions are exhausted. And the sensible thing would be to just release the crowd, let them go fend for themselves, relieve Jesus and the disciples of the responsibility to feed them and care for them. And this is another difference between the feeding of the 4,000 here in Mark 8 versus the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark 6. It seems that this crowd in Mark chapter 8 really does want to be with Jesus. They're not just there to be entertained. Verse 2 says Jesus says they have been with me now 3 days. Now, doesn't that suggest a special connection with Christ, a special commitment to Christ, to want to be with him and hear him? Not just to be entertained, not just to be fed by the food that he might create for them. No, this is purposeful. This is intentional. They want to hear him, willing to stick with him now for several days. And Jesus shows his compassion here in a couple of different ways. One is the personal identification. He says in verse 2, I have compassion on the crowd. He personally identifies with the suffering of the crowd, with their hardship. And that defines his whole ministry. One of personal presence and care. This is the outworking of his incarnation. I am with you always, he told the disciples in Matthew 28:20. Come to me, he says, and I will give you rest. I will give you rest. Several years ago, I had to have a medical procedure, and I was going to get a cortisone injection, and it was a very stressful, uncomfortable moment, and for this, they had to use x-ray technology, and so I was on this table and waiting for the doctor to do his thing, and there was a nurse, a technician nearby who could probably see the fear in my eyes, the unease with the whole situation, what was going to happen, that kind of thing. And she said, she stood beside the table and she said, you can hold my hand. Now, here was another human being offering a personal, caring presence. She could have stood aloof and detached across the room and busied herself with something, but she got involved. This is what Jesus does with us, with these people. He feels this compassion deeply. I have compassion in the crowd. And that personal identification then turned into pastoral care. Jesus is not removed or detached. He's there in person to watch and observe the crowds. He's sensitive to their needs. He knows personal details about them, that some of them have come from long distances, that some of them would faint if they had to be sent home along the journey. How does he know those things? Because he has invested in people. He's no doubt talked with these people. He's found out details about their lives. As 1 Peter 5:7 says, Jesus cares. Now, do you believe that? Like the hymn writer says, oh yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. When the days are weary and the long night dreary, I know my Savior cares. Jesus says, I have compassion on the crowd. He says that about you and about me. I have compassion on my people. I have compassion on the multitudes. Some people see here an underlying reference to the Gentiles. He's in Gentile territory. In verse 3, it says, some of them have come from far away. Probably a mixture here of Jews and Gentiles in the crowd, but Ephesians 2:17 says he came and preached peace to you who were far off and peace to those who were near. Acts 2:39, for the promises for you and for your children and for all who are far off. Maybe this is a hint to Mark's Roman Gentile readers, a possible foreshadowing of that great messianic banquet where people from every nation, tribe, and tongue will feast together on heavenly food. So there's the compassion of Christ, but then we see the dullness of the disciples. Secondly, the dullness of the disciples. Jesus summons them to fix the problem, and they respond in verse 4. How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? Jesus, we are far from civilization, or far removed from places where we can replenish our resources and supplies. And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. So the burning question is this. Have you forgotten the first miracle? Have you already forgotten that Jesus fed the 5,000? The 5,000 plus, women and children, maybe closer to 10,000 people. Some have rushed to the disciples' defense here and say, well, they forgot because considerable time has elapsed between this miracle and the first miracle. And maybe the disciples didn't want to presume that Jesus was going to solve this problem the same way that he did the first problem. Perhaps their question is but a dire reflection of their dire circumstances. They are in the wilderness. They're in a desolate place. There's no McDonald's. There's no Chick-fil-A. There's no Publix nearby where they can restock. But the context of Mark 8, where Mark talks extensively about the problems of the disciples, their slowness, their dullness, their hard-heartedness, would indicate that this is an indictment of the disciples and us as well. They have been spiritually insensitive to God's purpose, and so have we. They have been slow to understand, so have we. They are nearsighted and dominated by the moment, by the needs of the moment, thinking only in human terms. We've only got 7 loaves in the presence of so many people, just overwhelmed by what's in front of them. And this is how all of us react to Jesus, if we're honest. We can be very slow to understand. We expect so little from Christ. Even after he has met our needs repeatedly, we fail to assimilate and learn. Our hearts are hardened. Our minds are dull. The disciples' failure here to anticipate Jesus' miracle seems inexcusable. And there's no rebuke from Jesus. There's no rebuke from the narrator, but the larger context makes the point. We saw back in chapter 6 and verse 52, they had not understood about the loaves. They are teetering on the edge of spiritual blindness. And the answer to spiritual blindness is always found in Jesus Christ. So there's the compassion of Christ, the dullness of the disciples. But then finally, there are the blessings from the bread of life. The blessings from the bread of life. Jesus' miracle here, his miracles teach us something about his identity and his mission. So he cleanses the leper. And what do we learn about his identity and mission? That he redeems us from spiritual uncleanness and defilement. He casts out a demon or a legion of demons. He's come to destroy the works of the devil as part of his redemptive work. He feeds the multitude. He is the bread of life. So in what sense does Mark teach us that Jesus is the bread of life? What are some of these blessings from the bread of life? Well, there is abundance. Abundance. And we saw this in the Mark 6 miracle, the feeding of the 5,000 as well. Verse 8 here in Mark chapter 8 says, they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. So Jesus takes what is meager resources, scarce resources, these 7 loaves and few fish, and he multiplies them. And it's not that the individuals in the crowds just get a few crumbs. They received abundance. He did exceedingly beyond all they could ask or think. And it revealed his power, the bread's glorious multiplication. It reveals something of his suffering, something of his incarnation, something of his entering into our suffering. The metaphor of bread is often accompanied with adversity. So in Isaiah chapter 30, verse 20, the prophet speaks of the bread of adversity. Abundance. Nothing is too hard for the Lord. This superabundance fulfills the message of Isaiah 55, verse 1. Come everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Jesus' storehouses are full of boundless mercy and grace. For the sin-sick soul, there is forgiveness and healing. For the rebellious heart, there is sweet complicity and obedience to God's ways. For the troubled heart, there is peace and refreshment in Christ. For these disciples, their resources were meager. They were in a position where only the Son of God could help them. They could not rely on material provisions, for they had none. Their provisions were exhausted. Christ himself was their only resource. And so for the disciples, this lesson was the one they needed to learn repeatedly. And so Mark records multiple instances of Jesus doing these miraculous feedings to remind them that when their resources were depleted, that Jesus would be the bread of life. It's something that we need to learn repeatedly as well, because we are prone to sink our hope into this worldly stuff, this worldly materialism. We think what is tangible, what we can touch and see and feel, this is what will save us and sustain us and satisfy us. A couple years ago in Florida, there was a couple that left behind their everyday life to fulfill their dream, which was to buy a sailboat and have a once-in-a-lifetime adventure. So they sold all their belongings, sold their car, bought a sailboat for $5,000. And then it took them a year to outfit this vessel, took another $5,000. So a lot of money they sunk into this adventure. This was going to be happiness for them. But then on day two of their journey, their 28-foot boat hit something in the water in the Gulf of Mexico near Madeira Beach, and the boat capsized, and water began flooding into the cabin. The couple grabbed social security cards and cash and IDs and their dog as they called for rescue. A rescue ship showed up an hour later, but the water was too shallow for them to approach, and the couple had to jump into the water and leave this dream vessel behind. And the woman, when she was interviewed for this story, said, "Everything that I've worked for, everything I've owned since I was a child, I brought with me, and it's just floating away. And there's nothing I can do." It's a picture of what happens if we sink our hope and happiness into things of this world. They just will float away. Either when we die and leave this earth, leave them behind, they will just float away, or they will lose their value over time. Here, this bread fed the multitude, but they would get hungry again. And Jesus was saying that the material is not enough for humanity. It's not sufficient. Man shall not live by bread alone, Matthew 4, verse 4. If I'm focused on the material, I will shrivel up. You know, you think of the 20 or 30-year-old that's in peak condition, in the prime of life. They eat veggies and yogurt, no fats, no junk. They lavish themselves in designer labels. They work out regularly and transport their bodies in a nice automobile, but they've shrunk themselves to a body and little more if that's all they live for. Because as the years go by, the body will betray you. Your body will betray you. The automobile will wear out and rust. The clothes will eventually go threadbare. When the skin begins to sag, the clothes no longer look right, you will learn. Man shall not live by bread alone. It's a lesson that we have to learn repeatedly. The disciples needed to understand that Jesus is the universal bread. There is no life for anyone apart from him. So blessings from the bread of life, one is abundance. And then another lesson is satisfaction, sufficiency. Verse 8 says they ate and were satisfied. There was a great surplus. A picture here of the new creation, when there will be no famine or shortage. The Lord's supply will always meet and exceed the demand. Christ did not break the bread and then suddenly there were huge piles of bread and fish. He kept on breaking it slowly, methodically, bit by bit. The people came to Jesus hungry and famished. So hungry that Jesus feared they might collapse on the way home. But when their power to get food was exhausted, Christ's power to feed them was not. He had limitless power to provide for their needs. And it's a picture of how Jesus fills our souls with eternal life, completely satisfying the hungry, famished soul. I like the way John Piper puts it in his book, Desiring God. He says, "I know of no other way to triumph over sin long term than to gain a distaste for it because of a superior satisfaction in God." And there is an elasticity to our souls. The more we eat of this bread of life, the more we want, and our souls expand. And the more our souls expand, the more we're able to eat. And we are meant to hunger for this universal, eternal bread of life, to eat and eat. And so Jesus, by this miracle, is saying to us, I am a God of abundance. I am sufficient. I can meet the deepest needs of the famished soul. So come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price.